Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Andy Roth. Andy is professor of sociology at Sonoma State University in California. He's also associate director of Project Censored. His research explores how journalistic conventions shape news content and coverage of environmental issues. We're going to talk about major world and national issues on Andy's mind. Let me just mention one thing to begin the program. There are a number of topics that have become core issues for me. I write often on them. One of them is wrongfully imprisoned political prisoners. I focus mostly on America. I also discuss Israel. I discuss Canada and occasionally someone else. I get so busy in what I'm doing, I generally check my mail maybe a couple of times a week, usually when I'm running out to do an errand or something or other. And I had an errand this morning, and I checked my mail, and I got a letter from an incredible woman who I've written more about than any other political prisoner in America. Her name is Lynn Stewart. Lynn and I met each other some years ago when she was free. She was wrongfully imprisoned. She's the kind of person they should build a statue to and honor her. For 30 years, she was a heroic human rights lawyer. She did it because it was the right thing to do. She defended the wrong client. Apparently, that was her crime, and the Justice Department went after her, and they rigged the case against her. It was absolutely bogus from A to Z. Had no credibility whatever. But you know the way rogue prosecutors work. They intimidate jurors. They come up with fake evidence. They use secret evidence that defense counsel don't have access to. They use all kinds of conniving ways to get people convicted and put in prison instead of being free, which is where they belong. Well, Lynn originally was sentenced to 16 months. She appealed. She shouldn't have gotten 16 seconds, let alone 16 months. She appealed. The appeals court was even rougher than the district judge, who I think was really on Lynn's side, but he had no choice but to give her something, or maybe his tenure on the court would have been short. The appeals court was very angry about it. They remanded back to the district court. Lynn ended up with 10 years. 10 years. 10 years for doing the right thing. That's the kind of justice there is in America. I'm going to answer Lynn. I'm looking at the note that she wrote to me. It was really a holiday greeting, wishing me the best throughout the year. She mentioned how boring prison life is. I mean, what the devil are you going to do there? I'd like to write a book about political prisoners. I had my editor interested in doing it. She couldn't convince her committee that I guess signs off on what topics they're going to write about. It's not that they don't want to discuss the subject. They need to publish stuff that will at least cover their costs. Otherwise, they won't be in the publishing business very long. They're a wonderful publisher, Clarity Press. They published two of my books. My new one came out a few weeks ago, Banker Occupation, Waging Financial War and Humanity. That followed my book, How Wall Street Fleeces America. And probably my editor, who's a wonderful woman to work with, she'll probably ask me to do something else. And I'm going to bring up the topic of political prisoners because I would love to write a book about that. I've got so much information that I'd love to share with people. I picked a title. Haven't looked at it for a while, so I'd have to check it to see what it was. But it was a kind of title that jumped out and hit me between the eyes. I hope it would do the same for readers if I ever get to publish the book. And if I do, Lynn will be my feature chapter. She won't be the only one because there are lots of people, wonderful people, who shouldn't be there. I think I've written about Lynn, at least 8 times, maybe more than that, because I kept updating things that happened to her, and I'll do it again. When something important comes up, I'll write more about her. I had her on another program that I hosted before she ended up in prison. I had her husband on with her. I had her husband on again. He's a longtime activist. Anyway, I wanted to be able to tell Lynn in the note I'm going to write her this weekend and get off to her in the mail that I mentioned her on my program, and I started off my program today by talking about her. And let me just say I did it because I honor her. She's the kind of person that inspires me. She should inspire anybody. I'd be proud to have the kind of record over a lifetime that Lynn Stewart combined. Well, you know, you do those things, you risk ending up in prison. Anyway, Andy, I welcome you to the program. I wanted to get that in. Lynn writes every now and then. It's not easy communicating from prison, as you can imagine. I mean, it's really hard for any of us to imagine because we're on the outside and they're on the inside, but it's not easy. And here, a letter came from Lynn, and I thought the best way, besides answering her, which I'll do in snail mail, I wanted to do it on air, so now I've done it. Welcome, Andy.
Thanks so much, Steve. And much of what you say about Lynn Stewart could also apply to the 166 men who remain imprisoned as of today at Guantanamo Bay, held by the United States government. We're, of course, in the midst of observing a shameful 11th anniversary of injustice at Guantanamo Bay. That shameful anniversary is compounded, I think, by the fact that it's been 4 years since President Obama issued an executive order to close Guantanamo. And on the day he did that, he quoted Supreme Court Justice Brandeis to the effect that sunshine is the best disinfectant. But the story of Guantanamo and the 779 men who have been imprisoned there since January 11th, 2002, over that period, of whom 166, as I say, remain today, is a dark story, certainly in the nation's history, and one we can do something about. And I welcome the chance to focus our attention on that here on the show today, Steve. Thanks.
Andy, the article, I put out two articles this morning, and one of them, which really was my feature article, was titled, U.S. Law Prohibits Transferring Guantanamo Prisoners to America. And I began it saying, Fiscal Year 2013, National Defense Authorization Act prescribes it. January 11, 2013 marks Guantanamo's 11th anniversary, and I said more on that below. And then I said on January 11, 2002, its first 20 prisoners arrived. It's one of many U.S. torture prisons globally, and most there are innocent victims. Let me just mention a couple of things briefly that I said, because I remember writing about this stuff before. Mark Denebo at Seton Hall University, a law professor, did extensive research on Guantanamo, and I cited material that he produced in the past, several articles I wrote in the past on what he did. But among the things he revealed was that the vast majority of Guantanamo detainees were not accused of hostile acts. Afghan bounty hunters seized around 95% of them. They sold them to U.S. forces for $5,000 per claimed Taliban, for $25,000 for alleged al-Qaeda fighters. U.S. forces did not demand evidence. They wanted prisoners. They wanted bodies. They wanted to lock people up. They wanted to convince Americans and other people that they were effectively fighting the war on terror. So grab everybody. Anybody, grab your next door neighbor, grab a cab driver, grab a baker, a butcher, a candlestick maker, put him in prison and say you locked up a terrorist. That's what Guantanamo is. Yeah. That's what all the rest of this stuff is.
And indeed, just to expand briefly on those numbers before setting a mental frame for thinking about the topic we're addressing today, just one more kind of figure on that that corresponds exactly with what you're saying about the bounties and the roundups of innocent people. Since 2009, by determination of both the former Bush administration and the current Obama administration, since 2009, 86 of the 166 men who remain imprisoned at Guantanamo have been cleared for release. In other words, after thorough investigation by both the current and the previous executive administration and all the security apparatus under the power of those administrations, the determination was those 86 men pose no threat to the United States. They don't belong in Guantanamo at all, and yet they've been there for 4 years. I'd just like, as a kind of thought experiment and a way of getting our heads around something that is almost unthinkable, I'd like to ask everyone to take a moment and imagine all that you've done in your life since this time 11 years ago, since January 2002. Where have you lived? What jobs have you held? what things have you accomplished in your professional life or your personal life? If you're a parent, what have you seen your children become capable of doing? Or perhaps imagine your husband, your son, or your brother. What have those people's lives been like for the full duration of the past 11 years since 2002? And now imagine that for that entire time, whether it's you or a husband or a son or a brother, imagine during that entire time being held in captivity by a foreign power without charge or trial, in other words, no due process whatsoever. You may have spent time during that 11 years in solitary confinement. You may have been IRFed, to use a term that Almerindo Ojeda, one of the contributors to Censored 2013, helps us understand, and we can talk about that more later. You may have been tortured, perhaps waterboarded or dryboarded, possibly multiple times. It's terrible even to contemplate. But that's the reality for, of those 166 men who I mentioned, 16 of them have been held in Guantanamo since the very first day that it was in operation, January 11th, 2002. And I think it's almost impossible for, as you mentioned, Stephen, at the outset, talking about Lynn Stewart, and it's so good of you to remember her and remind the people listening of her and her case. The reality is, for these 16 men at Guantanamo, that that's what the last 11 years of their lives have been like. So I think it's important to keep that in mind. There are, of course, another 150 who have been there for less time, but any time in Guantanamo is almost impossible for us to imagine. But we have to. We have to deal with this because it's on our shoulders. It's the government doing this to these men in our names and in the names of our security and safety. So we must address these issues.
Well, we absolutely must. And if innocent people in America, I suppose a democracy, if innocent people end up behind bars, and it's not just a handful, it's not just Lynn and a few others, oh my goodness, I've written about five or six dozen people just in America alone. I've yet to run across a single individual out of the ones that I've written about. And of course, I can't write about everybody. I honestly feel that that most of the people in U.S. prisons aren't necessarily political prisoners, but they don't belong there at all. There are many, many, at least hundreds, maybe thousands, that at least border on the classification of being a political prisoner. There are so many others who may have done marginally wrong things, in part because we have insane laws like you possess a drug and a cop catches you with it in your pocket or in your automobile or something, and they can arrest you and they can put you on prison on possession charges. Well, my goodness, I mean, some of the illegal drugs, I don't think any of the drugs are safe, but some of the illegal ones, let's say, are less harmful than the legal ones. Well, you can overdose on the legal ones, and the drug companies will say, bravo, get more. Politicians in Washington will go along with it. They don't even check to see just how safe or unsafe some of these drugs are. They let kids take dangerous drugs, and some of them die. I just heard a report the other day on it. I mentioned it on my Friday program. I mean, this stuff goes on all the time. These people don't belong in prison. They never should have been charged. But even some people who did minor things, they should have gotten a reprimand. At most, they should have gotten a minor slap on the wrist, maybe a small fine. Put them in prison. America has the biggest prison population in the entire world by far, and it keeps getting bigger. It's a prison industrial complex. Andy, I could go on and that topic. I hope I'll be able to write a book about it one day.
I hope so too, Stephen. I mean, that's a... prisons are a topic certainly that Project Censored addresses. Our number 9 story is a cluster of stories on prison slavery in today's USA, and the fact that thousands are placed in solitary confinement every day, often for having committed minor disciplinary infractions. All this puts me in mind of a fantastic quote from Simone Weil, in a short essay she wrote on the Iliad, which she referred to as the poem of force. And in that essay, Simone Weil observes, and I think this is so appropriate, and it was much in my mind as I was writing a chapter on targeted killing for the Censored 2013 book. Simone Weil writes, "Force is as pitiless to the man who possesses it, or thinks he does, as it is to its victims. The second, it crushes. The first, it intoxicates." And the idea that force crushes its victims but intoxicates those who think they possess it, I think is such that's such a cautionary observation. We see the U.S. government failing to heed again and again, and nowhere, to my way of thinking, is it more obvious than in our current approach to international relations, which it seems to be premised on indefinite detention, extraordinary rendition, torture, and under President Obama, increasingly targeted assassination via unmanned aerial vehicles or drones. So force is pitiless to those who think they possess it. That was the lesson Simone Weil took from her close reading of Homer's The Iliad.
Oh, indeed, Andy. Go on with that, please.
Yeah, well, I mean, when we think about it in terms of in the context of Guantanamo, nine of the men and boys imprisoned at Guantanamo, and it's worth noting just in passing that a number of the people in Guantanamo, the youngest was captured at age 16 and died at age 21. Nine of the prisoners who have died in custody have died under it's an understatement to say could be characterized as highly suspicious circumstances. So Jason Leopold this week has a piece in Truth Out about the September 2012 death of one of the prisoners at Guantanamo, Adnan Farhan Abdul Latif. In Censored 2013, we brought forward as one of our top 25 stories reporting by Almirando Ojeda, the director of the Guantanamo's Testimonial Project at University of California, Davis. Dr. Ojeda reports on the deaths of Ali Abdul Ahmed, Mani Shaman Alabardi Al-Tabi, and Yasser Al-Zarani in summer of 2006. In all four of these cases, so Latif, as Leopold reports this week, and Ahmed Al-Tabi and Al-Zarani, the official verdict was suicide. Latif, as Leopold reports, supposedly by drug overdose, and as Ojeda reports about the three who died in 2006, supposedly by hanging themselves using bed sheets or towels. But in each case, scrutiny of the official records reveals fundamental discrepancies in even the official accounts of how these men died. As Leopold reports this week, standard operating procedures appear to not have been followed in Guantanamo, even by the official accounts that he's been able to secure, and informal reports off the record from people he's spoken with. So that death is highly suspicious. And as Ojeda reports, as he told me in conversation at one point, the evidence on the three men who supposedly hung themselves in summer 2006 just didn't add up. And here's the kind of thing Ojeda meant. They were all found hanging with their mouths bound with cloth and their hands tied behind their backs. And you probably don't need to be a forensic investigator to wonder, how can someone whose hands are bound hang themselves? And or how is it possible to hang yourself and then bind your own hands? It just, as Ojeda says, just doesn't add up. So these suspicious deaths are just one more reason that we desperately need to pursue justice at Guantanamo and ultimately close Guantanamo.
Absolutely. And of course, Guantanamo. Guantanamo is the best known. Even Americans and most other people who know nothing about the global network of U.S. prisons and all the rest of it associated with America's imperium, they have heard Guantanamo, and they may know it's in Cuba, but that's not what it means to them. It means that America has a prison camp there. They may know a little this, a little that about what goes on, but they don't know enough, and they certainly don't focus on it. They don't think about it. And the major media, the ones I call the scoundrel media, they say as little as possible about it. They don't acknowledge that torture is official U.S. policy. Andy, I remember some years ago writing about that. Literally, I mean, it's there in black and white. You can see it in some of the laws. You can see it in George Bush's executive orders, his memoranda, in his legal counsel's opinion. Men like John Yeo. I mean, it's absolutely outrageous. I mean, you come to one conclusion. They're literally smoking guns. Torture is official U.S. policy. It's okay to do anything you want to people on the pretext that, you know, they're ticking time bombs or whatever, and we need to do what we got to do to find out what we got to find out. But, of course, it's also acknowledged that torture tells you nothing. It tells you nothing. You can get anybody to say anything you want them to just to stop the pain. I mean, you beat up on somebody badly enough, long enough, they'll tell you anything. They just want you to stop. I mean, my God, I mean, they'd rather you executed them than to keep inflicting this unbearable pain. But that's what goes on, and it still goes on. And 700, 800 that have gone through Guantanamo. It's in my article. I forget the precise number. And 166 still there. There shouldn't be one still there. There never should have been one brought there in the first place. How many people in America know this stuff, Andy? It really is shocking. I like to suggest to people. I've done it to some friends. I've done it just chit-chatting with people. I live downtown in Chicago. I'm pretty close to a few very busy intersections. And if I stood out on a mild day, today's a mild day, unusual for January here. But if I stood out on a mild day on a busy corner taking a survey, people do that every now and then for various reasons. And I ask people about Guantanamo. Are you familiar with Guantanamo, or what does Guantanamo mean to you? Can you tell me what the purpose of it is? If I ask questions like that, I get a lot of name recognition, but I wouldn't get much of anything else. Most people wouldn't have a clue that there are people there, that they're being tortured, that they're all innocent, and America is responsible for the whole thing because of the phony war on terror. Absolutely a hoax. I fear, you know, get Americans to be scared to death so they'll go along with anything you want to do. I don't think I'd find 1 in 100 people who could explain half of that, Andy. Andy? Ooh, are we disconnected? I must have lost Andy. Maybe we can get him back on the phone again. Didn't realize he went off. Well, anyway, I wrote a book about Guantanamo and what went on, and the fact that I wrote about the fact that the 2012 NDAA, it gave Obama diktat authority. He signed it on New Year's Eve. You know, when something nasty comes along, whether it's a law they want to sign, whether it's a piece of news that's particularly distressing, it's best to have it come out when people aren't paying attention. So on New Year's Eve 2012, Obama signed the NDAA. Andy, I know you're on. I'll just finish this thought and jump right back to you.
Thanks so much.
It gave Obama diktat authority to order anybody in the world, including U.S. citizens, no matter where they are, arrested, put in a military prison, left there indefinitely, held charged, uncharged, tried, untried, and they literally could stay there forever. The issue was brought up again in the 2013 NDAA. The same provision is back in the law. Obama signed it again on New Year's Eve. The irony, the outrageousness, not only New Year's Eve, but last year and this year, he was vacationing in Hawaii, enjoying himself. enacting a law that can put anybody in jail, in prison, unjustly, for no reason at all. There it is again. And part of the law was saying that, included in this law, Guantanamo prisoners are prohibited from being transferred to America to a civil court. Everybody deserves a trial in civil court. Military tribunals are absolutely legitimate. There's no legitimacy to a military tribunal. There's nothing in the Constitution that allows it. There's nothing in international law that allows it. Andy, I'll stop with that. But anyway, I spotted the anniversary.
I'm happy to add a few words on the NDAA. It's a story, obviously, Project Censored has been tracking, and in fact, it was part of our... The NDAA constitutes part of a crucial part of our number one story in the 2013 book on signs of an emerging police state. And so the renewal of those components of the NDAA that you've just highlighted involving indefinite detention in the 2013 NDAA are that much more troubling. And you're quite right about how the provisions, the impact of these provisions on the potential for justice at Guantanamo is truly a setback, because the NDAA, as you say, restricts transfer of prisons to the U.S. for trial. It also restricts the executive from transferring the detainees to any foreign country. So even those 86 men who, by all accounts, are cleared and ready to be transferred cannot be under the terms of the NDAA of 2013. We're really talking here about a kind of an odd sort of version of executive power. On one hand, it's as if we've gone back to pre-1215, that is the year 1215, before the writ of habeas corpus, when the king could do whatever he wanted, and there was no recourse. If the king wanted to throw you in jail, the king could throw you in jail, and you had no right to a trial. You had no right to the evidence against you. You had basically no legal rights, and that's what we've got under the NDAA. The flip side is that when Obama signed the NDAA, he also issued a signing statement noting that he did not approve of the aspects of the NDAA relating to and impacting justice at Guantanamo. But the interesting thing here is that, you know, as president, President Obama is also the commander-in-chief of the military. And he could act on the basis of the principles articulated in his signing statement, taking exception to the Guantanamo aspects of the 2013 NDAA. We'll see if he does. But the track record, going back, you know, to his promise and his order 4 years ago, doesn't leave a lot of room for hope that we'll see justice at Guantanamo under the terms of the 2013 NDAA, even with the president's signing statement taking exception. This is something I'd like, if I could, to launch a bit of a topic here, a framework that I've been thinking about a lot in terms of these issues, the idea of a shifting baseline syndrome. And by shifting baseline syndrome, if I could, before relating it to the issue of unjust political imprisonment and so forth, the concept actually comes from conservation biology. In its original usage in the 1990s, the idea of a shifting baseline was used by biologists who were studying the salmon population of the Columbia River in the Pacific Northwest. And what they found was that the 1990s population was twice as great as it had been in the 1930s along the Columbia River. And that sounded like the tremendous gains had been made on the basis of conservation efforts. But what those same biologists found was when they went back and looked at the 1990s salmon population compared to what had been found along the Columbia in the 1800s, the 1990s population was just 10% of the salmon population in the 1800s. And the kind of conclusion is that any determination of an ecosystem's health or its degradation depends on what baseline we use. right? If you lose track of earlier conditions, if you don't know, for instance, that in the 1800s the salmon population was tremendous compared to what it was in either the 1930s or the 1990s, then you're subject to a shifting baseline. You don't really know what the standard ought to be. And I think this concept applies not only to conservation biology, but also politically, legally, and sociologically. And so that when we think about the world and America's place in the world since 9/11/2001, I think what we see are massively shifting baselines. To just kind of run the argument very quickly and schematically, the first major shift of those would be the convincing people that indefinite detention was acceptable and indeed necessary for national security. So indefinite detention shifts the baseline away from what had been a cardinal point of rule of law under a democratic society, which was the principle of habeas corpus. Once you shift the baseline to allow for indefinite detention, as we had in black sites around the world, and most prominently, I suppose, at Guantanamo, then you open up it perhaps becomes more acceptable to have torture of those men who are indefinitely detained. And once torture becomes acceptable, and I want to talk some about the role that the film Zero Dark Thirty plays in rendering torture acceptable. Once torture is acceptable, then the outright extrajudicial killing of people becomes less outlandish and perhaps more acceptable. So I think in terms of a shifting baseline syndrome, since 9/11, politically and legally, the move from the rule of law to indefinite detention, to the acceptability of torture, to the acceptability of extrajudicial assassination, what we've got is a shifting baseline. And as I point out in Censored 2013, talking about this concept, when we lose track of earlier conditions, our baselines shift, and we are more ready to accept, often without awareness of having done so, degradations that in the past would have been deemed unacceptable.
So true. So true, Annie. So true. It really is a very dark time, and it's not getting any brighter. We're going to take a short break, Annie. I write about this stuff. My goodness. I wrote a lot about NDAA last year. I've written about the new one this year. I write about tyranny in America, all the horrors that go on, and all of the things that are done so wrong that cause so much harm to so many people. The richest country in the world that could do such wondrous things if people governing the country put their minds to it and focus on what's right instead of what they do. Imagine the kind of world we could live in instead of the way things are now. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and continue with this. Talking about a lot of things. Sometimes, Andy, on the program, we'll just kind of go from topic to topic. A lot of the important ones keep coming up all over again. We're talking about stuff that's going on here in America. Another key focus of me is what's going on abroad. I'm sure you're watching it the way I do. I've written so much about Syria. Last year, I wrote volumes about Libya. I write often on Iran and the fake so-called nuclear threat that Iran poses, or claiming that Iran wants to wipe Israel off the map, or Iran threatens its neighbors. I mean, talk about turning truth on its head. Iran hasn't attacked another country in two or three centuries. Its nuclear program is entirely peaceful. I'm not saying it. U.S. intelligence says it. Every year they come up with an annual assessment. 16 U.S. intelligence agencies, they say basically the same thing every year. All officials in Washington know it. The Israelis know it. The European rogues know it. And yet they keep targeting Iran and saying this, that, and everything else. My goodness, I'm sure you take a look at what's going on overseas, Andy.
Yes, yes. We follow quite closely. I want to give a shout-out here to Michelle Chodzudovsky and the website that he maintains out of Canada, Global Research, which has done some of the best, I think, reporting that can be found on these issues, especially Syria and Libya. And there are a number of stories sourced back to Global Research in the Censored 2013 book. Right, it's just, I mean, I think what we're talking about here, the underlying issues in many ways are the same, and I want to come back to that theme, the intoxication of power. That Simone Weil warns against, right? That force is pitiless. Those who think they possess it are intoxicated by it, and U.S. foreign policy, I think, is accurately characterized in just those terms. We don't seem to be acting with reason. We seem to be intoxicated by our own power, or the illusion of our own power. And so then we're quite surprised when there is blowback. And in many cases, we never want to blame the victims, but in many cases, I think we have to turn a wary eye. And again, I come back to this idea, like Weil's point is that force is pitiless to all involved. It crushes the people who it's used against, but the people who believe that they control it, and this was her lesson from looking at the Iliad, was the people who think they're in control of force seldom stay in control of it for very long.
Well, I hope the U.S. forces that certainly are trying to get control of a planet Earth, and that's no exaggeration, I hope they will come a cropper just like all the other empires, Andy. It's shocking that this is the way America uses its resources. I've written volumes on the fiscal cliff, the so-called fiscal cliff. It's too bad. Some of it is in my new book. But the main debate, the way it always takes place, it takes place at the 11th hour, so my publishing date was cut off, and an awful lot of writing that I did and focusing on it in discussion, in interviews, and on this program came after my publishing date was cut off. But the fiscal cliff, I stress very strongly, is a hoax. The idea is to destroy America's social contract. There's always enough money to wage all the wars America wants to fight. There's always plenty to hand to the bankers. Corporate subsidies never get shortchanged. The super rich get all the breaks in the world. It's only the little people that end up taking it in the ear. And that's the way the system works. And it's never explained. The media scoundrels don't explain it. But that's what the so-called fiscal cliff is all about. And the worst is yet to come. What happened at year-end and a day or two into the new year was just a skirmish. It was just a skirmish. Just wait and see what's coming. And they'll do it very cleverly.
And essentially, I mean, our political representatives essentially punted, right? They didn't resolve the issue, an issue, of course, as you're suggesting, of their own creation, but they punted on it so they can go do it again. Again, I think I come back to, I don't want to sound like this is a one-size-fits-all concept, but this idea of shifting baselines applies here, too. In the book, I talk about how shifting baselines apply in at least three institutional domains that are elementary for our society. The first of those, as we've been talking about some with Guantanamo and force and law, is the increasing regulation of individual behavior in political and legal spheres. The second, and this applies directly to the fiscal cliff, is the consolidation of wealth and the externalization of the consequences of the consolidation of wealth that constitute economic power. And finally, and this, I think, is in some ways an overarching concept, is the conglomeration of media and the consequent loss of diversity of news content. If I could, Steve, I'd love to talk a little bit about one of the shifters. If we have shifting baseline syndrome, and we can talk, for instance, as we have about the NDAA and the nomination of John Brennan to head the CIA, which was totally unacceptable when President-elect Obama floated the idea in November of 2008 and now appears to be completely acceptable. I'd like to talk some about what I see as one of the shifters that's at work right now, and that's the role of popular culture in all this. The film Zero Dark Thirty has been getting a lot of attention, certainly this week, and I think it is, in some ways, you can think of this as one of the shifters. As a cultural object, it's attempting to convince the American public of some fundamental untruths. It's a film that relentlessly attempts to justify the unjustifiable, torture, extrajudicial assassination. And protests against the film have been dismissed by its defenders as essentially, well, that's getting political, right? That's politically motivated. But the point is that torture and extrajudicial assassination are moral issues. These are criminal issues. And so to say that, oh, well, that's political and the film doesn't deal in political terms, I think is a real deception and a misdirection. The bottom line for me is that Zero Dark Thirty never acknowledges that torture and targeted killing are moral and criminal issues. You know, it's quite interesting to me when we talk about a kind of popular culture, this isn't singular. It's got, you know, and it's part of, as I mentioned there with shifting down baselines, it's part of a media context. So earlier this week, David Letterman one night featured Jessica Chastain, who's the actress who plays the kind of heroic lead character Maya in Zero Dark Thirty. She was on one night, and she kind of, with Letterman, sort of nervously laughed and smiled through a two-minute interview where she assured Letterman that, in her opinion, director Catherine Bigelow and screenwriter Mark Boal didn't do anything inappropriate. They didn't have any inappropriate access to classified information. And Letterman kind of kidded her that, well, now that she's on record, the Senate may want to question her, and they kind of both had a shared laugh over the idea of Senate investigations. But the fact of the matter is there are serious Senate investigations into being led, among others, by Senator Dianne Feinstein, being led. There are serious investigations about whether there was inappropriate access and CIA, the extent of CIA involvement in the making and promotion of the film. And I think that's a serious issue in terms of propaganda. As if that wasn't enough, though, a night or two later, Letterman had on Catherine Bigelow, the director of Zero Dark Thirty, herself. And Letterman began somewhat seriously asking her about the depiction of torture in the movie, and Bigelow takes a long in-breath and says, it's a movie, right? And she goes on to explain that, well, they tried to capture the essence of what happened, but it's a movie. And she says, we compressed 10 years of the world events into 2.5 hours. Again, this kind of this... On one hand, the film begins with the actual audio tracks of people in the towers in New York City on 9/11 calling, and then it goes on. So it begins as a matter of fact and a matter of historical record in a way that cannot but be emotionally charging to the audience of the movie. And then it goes on to become, as in Bigelow's words, a movie that tries to capture the essence of what happened. In the same interview with Letterman, so again, this is the kind of the pop cultural spin and the pop cultural frame on torture and extrajudicial assassination. She goes on to say EITs were employed. EITs are enhanced interrogation techniques or torture. There was no follow-up by Letterman. I think it's safe to say that as far as issues like this go, Letterman is no Jason Leopold or Jane Meyer or Greg Palast. His response was to kid that I was waterboarded in college all the time. And again, these most serious issues facing our democracy as a society supposedly guided by the rule of law were treated on Letterman by the filmmakers and the actresses, actor involved in the film, and by Letterman himself as kind of matters to be addressed but not taken too seriously. And this is deeply troubling to me. Again, this is what I would describe as this is an effort at shifting the boundaries, not on political or legal terms, but here in the kind of the cultural sphere as part of an entertainment media that nonetheless is influential on how people think about the real world and the fate of humans at the hands of government power, U.S. government power, in that real world.
Andy, I would just add that a primary role of Hollywood for so many years, my goodness, I'm still old enough to remember the kind of stuff, the movies that came out during World War II. I was really too young to understand them. You know, John Wayne and the rest of them, and, you know, Americans, the good guys, beating the bad Japanese, the Germans, or whatever. These were all propaganda films. And that's what Hollywood does. The major media, they do it their way, either in print or now on television. No television during World War II. Came out after the war, but there was radio. Radio doesn't have the same impact that television has. But Hollywood was the great propaganda vehicle. And, you know, wave the flag and the rest of it, and that's what goes on. And whatever America does is right, and whatever the countries America calls bad guys do, they're wrong. One of the most dramatic war books that I read, what was the man's first name? His last name was Gower, I think, G-O-W-E-R. I read the book years ago about the war in the Pacific, and the title of the book was War Without Mercy. War Without Mercy. And if there was one theme to that book, Andy, it was that I still remember how the Japanese were beaten up on, and they were no sweethearts. I would be the last one to call Imperial Japan anything but a bunch of rogue gangster thugs. That's what they were. But the bottom line was that the worst of what they did, U.S. forces did exactly the same thing, and this book spelt it out chapter and verse. But, of course, Americans never got the U.S. side of the story from what U.S. forces did. They only heard about what the bad Japanese did, and that's the way propaganda works. That was a terrific book. If anybody can find a used copy of Gower, G-O-W-E-R, War Without Mercy, if you want to know what war is about, read that book, and you'll certainly know that America is not the good guy.
Yeah. That's an excellent recommendation. I know we're nearing the end of the hour. It always goes by so quickly with you, Steve. It's easy to get discouraged in the midst of all this, but there was actually, despite the setbacks that we've been talking about, the NDAA, the idea that John Brennan is going to become head of the CIA. There was actually some good news this week, I think. On the front of accountability for U.S. Military power and its reach around the world, the Center for Constitutional Rights had won a historic settlement in court on behalf of 71 torture victims from Abu Ghraib. The Center for Constitutional Rights brought a case against L3 Services, which was a contractor at Abu Ghraib, now owned. It's a subsidiary of Engility, which is a corporation out of Virginia. There were no criminal charges against the L3 contractors at Abu Ghraib, but a judge awarded a $5 million settlement to those 71 Abu Ghraib torture victims. And that's the first successful effort by lawyers on behalf of former prisoners at Abu Ghraib to collect money from a U.S. defense contractor in a lawsuit alleging torture. And another such contractor, CACI, C-A-C-I, is expected to face a similar suit. They will face a similar suit that's expected to go to trial, brought to trial by the Center for Constitutional Rights this summer. So this is, as I say, these were not criminal charges that were decided, and it's hard to imagine how a financial settlement can possibly compensate those 71 torture victims for what they endured in Abu Ghraib. But it is a measure of accountability, and it gives me hope that with persistent effort on our parts and with the American public waking up and realizing what's being done in our name by our government, that there might be more such accountability in the future.
Yeah, that's great news, Andy. They can either appeal and drag the thing out or just try to settle it very quietly, maybe come up with an agreement and mm-hmm. settle for so many cents on the dollar, however they do these things, sort of like a plea bargain, but of course mm-hmm. they're settling a lawsuit, just to kind of bury it. I want to mention this since we're still on air before the program ends. I looked up the book. The author's name is John W. Dower with a D like David, D-O-W-E-R. I looked it up on Amazon. The full title is War Without Mercy, Race and Power in the Pacific War. You can get a brand new copy for $10. For $10, you can get a used copy for $4.50 by going to Amazon. Either one is a steal. Get yourself a copy of the book, read it, and find out what America, you know what America is all about. But Dower in the Pacific, you know, and the so-called good war, I can't imagine a war that was any worse than World War II. That absolutely is the number one worst war, with who knows how many people died, 40, 50, 60 million people. Nothing good about anything like that. But for $4.50, you can read about what went on in the Pacific. And some of the same stuff went on in Europe. It wasn't just the Nazis or the Japanese. It was Americans and U.S. allies. They're the bad guys, just like all the other, but there are no good guys in wars. Anyway, Andy, we've got a couple of minutes left. Let me let you finish up with some final thoughts.
Yeah, well, you know, yesterday in D.C., there were major protests to mark the anniversary of Guantanamo, and one of the Center for Constitutional Rights representatives who spoke there yesterday said something that I think sums up a lot of what we've been talking about this morning in an effective way. The Center for Constitutional Rights, Lily Kashani, yesterday at the rally in D.C. said, "Will there be justice for the 166 men who are languishing at Guantanamo? I think the answer resides in us, in each of you. We know that power concedes nothing without a demand, so it's up to us to press on or not give up, and together make Guantanamo, unjust detentions, and U.S. belligerence more broadly a thing of the past." And I hope that everyone listening today will think about what they might be able to do in some small way, or maybe a large way, or to contribute to that shared collective effort to acknowledging that power concedes nothing without a demand. But that if we do what we have been doing and redouble our efforts and invite more people to join in our efforts, that we can push back against U.S. belligerence domestically and around the world and create the kind of society that we all aspire for, one that's based on a rule of law that respects the integrity and dignity of the individual, it is the kind of place that we would want our children and our nieces and nephews to inherit.
Well, Andy, that's the core theme I stress all the time. It is impossible to think you're going to get the politicians to give an inch. They have to be pressured. They have to be forced. And I wonder how many listeners are old enough to remember back to the 1960s, the early 1970s, the anti-war protests. And they played a major role. They certainly weren't the turning force entirely on ending that war. It was a very unpopular war. The soldiers fighting it absolutely despised it, and there was a draft back in those days. That's the big difference between then and now. But those anti-war protests, they were all over the country. They were everywhere. There were angry people that wanted that the war stopped, and there were people in Congress who weren't quite the way they are today. They were no sweethearts, but, you know, you had people like Fulbright and Frank Church Everett Dirksen, a Republican, there aren't any Republicans like Everett Dirksen around today. You had Eisenhower back in the 1950s. Certainly no Eisenhower Republicans around today. But people, angry people got the attention of Congress, and overseas forces that were angry, they got their attention. And finally, the powers that be decided that they could keep fighting this war forever, but they never were going to win it. That was known in the 1960s. And the war ended very, very simply when Congress just turned the faucet off. That's the way you end wars. You cut off the money, the wars come to an end. They left enough to bring the forces back. They did. Mid-April 1975, the humiliating rooftop exit from the Saigon embassy. I still remember that. I still remember not enough room left on aircraft carriers, I guess, to keep all the planes, the helicopters. So they just dumped them in the ocean. I remember that stuff. It was a long time ago. I was a lot younger. The wars can end now. Obama isn't going to end them. Congress isn't going to end them. Only we can end them. Only we can change things and make them the way they want. Only we can make things right. Turn wrong into right. That, well, you could call it political alchemy, except it's not alchemy. We literally can turn wrong into right if enough people decide they're going to do it and they convince others to go along with them. We're the real superpower, Andy. It's just a question of whether we're going to use the powers we have.
Thanks so much, Steve. I agree completely.
Andy, I look forward to getting you back again. Last weekend, you know, I had Peter and I had Mickey on, and we keep on these themes all the time. You guys are committed, so am I. I can't imagine anything more important. I know full well that America is on a fast track to a despotism, and literally, we're so far along now, I like to say we're a hair's breadth away. It literally is that close with these NDAAs passing, with all the other things before the Patriot Act ever passed. My God, anti-terrorism bills, lawless surveillance. It's one thing after another. Rights are being stripped away, social ones, political ones, economic ones. If we don't go to war against this stuff, it's going to get worse and worse. America isn't fit to live in now. Imagine how bad it's going to be ahead. Andy, again, many, many thanks. I'll just remind my listeners, join us again tomorrow. We'll be on again, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.